All right, welcome to the show. It's the Michael Slate Show. Really glad to be here today. I'm just feeling like I just want to run through everything. And maybe it's because I had a little bit of a cold for 4 or 5 days, but now I feel really good. Anyway, we have a packed show, so I'll just get right into it. At the back end of the show, we're going to be listening to a piece from Bob Avakian, which is about, it's called More Postcards of the Hanging, the Horrors Perpetrated Against Women Under the System. And it's from B.A. Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less, a speech given by Avakian in the fall of 2012. Check this out. You really need to check this out. Listen to it. Think about it. And act based on what you think about it. All right? And it's all tied in with the whole thing that's going on. All right? So we'll be taking a listen to that. Before that, we're going to be talking with Paige Korich-Klein, who's from No More Deaths. She's talking about the first in a series of trials of activists with No More Deaths. The activists are accused of various misdemeanors for leaving water, food, socks, and blankets in the Cabeza Prieta National Wildlife Refuge on the southern border between Arizona and Sonora, Mexico. So stay tuned for that. It's a really good interview. But opening the show up, I'm very pleased to be bringing to the show someone that I just came across when I was looking for what would be what I felt was an appropriate topic for today and an appropriately strong and critically true analysis of what's going on in the world, in particular in relation to the relationship between Mexico and, quite frankly, even going all the way south. You know, we have the thing all the way down to Honduras. And what's the relationship between that and what's happened? What happened in history around all this? And the person we're going to be speaking to is Alvaro Huerta, and he is an assistant professor of urban and regional planning and ethnic and women's studies at Cal State Polytechnic University in Pomona. Alvaro, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Sure, man, sure. Let's jump into this because there's so much to ask you.
Right.
You open up the piece that I read recently by stating that the historical ties, and you know, you think about this. This is, Trump is out there and he's telling people every day, every minute, he's telling people, the Mexicans, the people south of Mexico, they're coming up here, they're riding these wild horses to come in charge. It's the whole thing. It's the Cossacks coming in and they're trying to storm the borders. And with the Cossacks comes all the thieves and the drug dealers. And this is what he's painting as what's going on. Now, you open up your piece by stating that the historical ties of Mexican immigrants to the U.S. are a very different story. They're very different than the ties of other immigrant groups, especially white people. Let's talk about actually that beginning, okay?
Right. Yeah, I mean, Trump acts like Pancho Villa's coming back and invading the United States once again. It's just absurd. I mean, the Mexican people go back thousands of years to this land. I'm talking more the indigenous aspect, or the DNA of Mexicans is primarily indigenous. So we go back thousands of years. So this idea that we're foreigners or strangers or invaders is just absurd.
Mm-hmm. But it is out there in a really big way, which is really, you know, and especially in terms of when you look at what's happening today, and we'll get into this a little bit later, but the whole idea that the lives and the well-being and the comfort of white people in particular are being, you know, it's sort of, they're somehow being threatened by people who are, you know, one, portrayed as, again, yes, as the horde coming north. And one of the things you speak about is, it even goes so far as, I wasn't aware of this guy until you actually mentioned, then I looked up some of the stuff that he's written, but Samuel P. Huntington of Harvard. And I thought that was a fairly heavy statement that he's made in terms of, he had this article called The Hispanic Threat. And he claimed that Latinas and Latinos in general and individuals of Mexican origin in particular represented an existential threat to the U.S. Let's talk about that. And how widespread is that?
Right. Yeah, it's very deep. I mean, when you look at someone like Trump, he's very inarticulate and you can't really take him seriously. But this doesn't just apply to people like Trump. I mean, you have some of the most prestigious intellectuals in the world coming from Harvard, arguing that Mexicans are genetically inferior to whites. And it has to do with them being indigenous. But he also brings up this idea of religion, that Catholicism is inferior to Protestantism. And all these ideas that pit one group against the other. And it's all based on this idea of eugenics, which is, it's actually a pseudoscience. It's not really a science. That one race is inherently superior to the other, and this explains why, like, Europe is advanced, the United States' advance, and Latin America and Africa, or parts of Africa or parts of Latin America, are not advanced. So this is very widespread. Some people are more articulate and more sophisticated in the way they make this argument, and they pretty much hide it. I mean, you see this in Congress, and a lot of the congressional leaders, especially conservatives, they hold these beliefs, but you have a few people like King and Trump and others that are very explicit. But it's not just the far right or those that argue in a very gross way. It's also these intellectuals and others that make this argument based on the fact that whites are superior to brown and black people.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, and one of the things that came up in what you did, which I thought was really, really very, very important, very valuable, is that you looked at this. And again, I do think we have to take Trump seriously. We do have to take him seriously because he's a fascist who actually runs the most powerful fascistic, you know, country in the world, government in the world, you know. And this is, and he is, you know, he started from the moment he came into power, he started talking about the threat from the bad Mexicans, the threat from the people that are coming up and peering through the wall and looking for the ways to bore their way through and to come in and savage the American people, you know, who, when he says the American people, he's mainly, as everybody knows, it's sort of this catchphrase for the white people. And, you know, he brings this in. And I thought one of the things you spoke to very well in your piece was that basically for all this time that Trump has been saying this, there's a whole other history that many people don't even know about. And it's a history that tells a very different story. Let's talk about that phenomenon. And then the story, what is the actual story what's the truth about what's going on there?
The barbarians at the gate, the Mexicans are invaders. And now Trump is throwing in people from Honduras and El Salvador and places like that, and Haiti. But really, if you think about it, the true invaders in history, in terms of taking land and conquering people, have pretty much been European countries and countries like the United States. And this is history. This is not radical history. This is not like communist history. This is just history. It's portrayed as in high school and K-12 as something that's neutral, like when you say like the U.S.-Mexico War, makes it seem like it was just both parties were involved and it was a neutral war between two nations. It wasn't that. It was an imperialist war between the United States invading another country, Mexico. So the true invaders, if we're talking about invaders in terms of history, really the true invaders of the United States are invading or have invaded another country, which is Mexico. And it's not just we're not just talking about 1848 when they took most of the land. Earlier, the United States or residents of the United States or white citizens started to settle into what's now known as Texas, where they were allowed to settle by the Mexican government as long as they practiced the religion, as long as they married, you know, within the culture and they embraced the culture, and as long as they didn't bring in slavery, because by then Mexico had abolished slavery. So that was key. So, but once they settled, the people that settled, the white Americans that settled at the time, their intentions weren't to integrate, to acculturate to Mexican culture. Their intentions were to take the land. So eventually in 1836, you know, they took Texas, and then later, you know, they took the rest of the country, half of Mexican country. So when we're talking about invaders, then what I argue in this article is, as someone who studies history, is the real invaders have been the United States government in taking land from Mexican people, taking land from Puerto Ricans, taking land from Hawaiians. Right, so you know, we have to put it in historical context if we're going to use that language. Mm-hmm. So this is something I think that Americans in general and are, you know, ahistorical. They pretty much operate in terms of like today, but they don't really understand because they're not taught this history. What are some of the consequences of historical past, like slavery and things of that nature, and how that reality or those facts are still manifested today?
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Alvaro Huerta. He's an assistant professor of urban and regional planning and ethnic and women's studies at Cal State Polytechnic University in Pomona. And we're talking about, what's going on when Trump actually talks about the Mexicans and the people south of Mexico coming and storming the borders, trying to rape and pillage everything that's good in the world, which is, in their view, America, and actually the real truth about who did what to who. Now, Avar, tell me this. You know, it's interesting because in a lot of ways what you talk about in the article that you wrote, you talk about the impact of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo and at the seizure of Texas opening the door for a major land grab, which you began to talk about. And this had a huge impact on Mexico. It wasn't just that they stole this land and they set it up and too bad, you know, don't cry your crocodile tears to us. We did it fair and square. In fact, it actually had a major impact on Mexico and the Mexican people. Let's talk about that.
The treaty itself allowed for people that settled, for the Mexicans that decided to settle in what became the United States, they were given full rights, and they were allowed to keep their land, and they were allowed to practice their religion, their language, and their culture, and so on and so forth. But shortly thereafter, the United States, just like they did with Native Americans, you know, they have a practice of breaking treaties, so they broke the treaty, and the Congress ratified the treaty, and they pretty much took away a lot of these rights. And then through the courts and through other illegal means and violence, white Americans, citizens, and through the state, through the support of the state, started to take the land away from the Mexicans that had owned it prior to the occupation.
Mm-hmm.
So you see that the way the United States has dealt with the Mexican people from day one has been very hostile. And in reality, the Mexican people, and this has to do a lot with the Catholic Church, I mean, I'm an atheist, so I'm saying this objectively, but I was also born a Catholic. I was raised a Catholic. But the Catholic Church has indoctrinated or taught or teaches people to be docile and to be humble and to take this misery and where you'll be rewarded in heaven. Now, I say this because the Mexican people in general are very docile, very humble, they don't have a tradition. I mean, you have elements, like all people, of invading countries, of doing these type of things that they're being accused of, you know, because of the way they've been brought up and they've been raised and so on and so forth, right? So they're being painted or were being painted as this menace when in reality, you know, we've been the ones that have been victimized throughout history and continue to be victimized and blamed for America's problems.
Mm-hmm. You know,
now, the white working class in this country has problems, but those problems are not problems that we created. You know, those are problems that are based on capitalism and government neglect. But it's easy for those in power to say, oh, it's not us. It's those brown people over there that are causing your misery.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get a job because Pablo here is taking your job and so on and so forth. Now, those people themselves, they bought into this lie and they bought into this myth for their own benefit as well because they don't want to be held accountable or they lack personal responsibility. So instead of taking personal responsibility that I'm poor because I didn't go to college, they blame Pablo and they blame my mom and they blame my dad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so for me, this is unacceptable. And if Americans want to be, especially conservatives, if they believe in individual responsibility and accountability and the Protestant work ethic, then don't be crying about somebody outworking you.
Well, but the big thing, too, though, I mean, I think it's really important that people understand this. And I know a lot of people have, if anything, a minimal understanding of the history of Mexico
right.
and its relationship with the U.S., a lot of people in this country. And the problem is that all the stuff that you've been talking about, the fact that the Mexicans who decided to stay in the U.S. after that territory was seized by the U.S., they decided to stay in there, and they were supposedly protected by the treaties you were talking about, but they eventually ended up losing everything. And then you think about this, you think about what's going on today, and you think about the kind of, you know, the way things are presented so that, you know, when you think about Trump today beating the xenophobic drums about Mexicans and others coming to the U.S. to rape, pillage, and steal, you really have to remember who did what to who. He's painting this picture right. of all these people from Honduras on up, and especially at the Mexican border, they're trying to sneak in, they're trying to take everything that's really good and pure and everything else. And the reality is that the U.S. did exactly that to the Mexican people.
Right. It's actually the opposite. It's like the bully, you know, picking on the little guy and then going home and blaming, you know, the little guy for his actions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at the gangs with MS-13 and the gangs that are ravaged. There are menace in Central America and Mexico and places like that. But MS-13 was founded here in the United States.
Yeah.
You know, in the MacArthur Park area. So the United States exported the gangs to Central America. Right. When we're talking about drug addiction, there is a problem with drug addiction and the drug lords and the gangs in Mexico and throughout Latin America. But that wouldn't exist if there wasn't a high demand for drugs here. So it's like it's a supply and demand. So yes, there is a problem, but also we have to look inward, and Americans have to take that responsibility to say, you know, if there wasn't a large demand for it, the supply wouldn't be there. So it's very easy and convenient to blame the other.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is that the United States has major problems, and they have to look in themselves and take on that responsibility and accountability versus trying to blame someone else for what they caused.
Yeah, and we're going to have to wrap this up, but I also want to add that actually people have to dig into, and one of the reasons why I really wanted you on the show today is because of the truth that you told about the relationship between Mexico and the U.S. historically and currently, and I think it's really important. It's important that people know that, hello, folks, you're being lied to, left, right, up, down, you know. This is, and it's not just Trump. It goes all the way back. We can trace it all the way back to the beginning. But we are going
to... not just Trump. I mean, the wall has nothing to do with Trump. It has to do with the fear and the racism against brown people in this country. And the fact of the matter is that brown people, Mexican people, Central Americans, African Americans, you know, people from African Haiti, they have a strong work ethic, beautiful people, beautiful culture, and they should be embraced instead of rejected and vilified.
All right. On that note, we are going to have to wrap this up, but I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you. I'll come back for a part two.
All right, great. I'll look forward to it. All right,
okay,
thanks,
thank
Alvaro.
You.
All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Dr. Alvaro Huerta, an assistant professor of urban and regional planning and ethnic and women's studies at Cal State Polytechnic University in Pomona. And we've been talking about the reality of who's threatening who. They accused the various immigrant people of coming in and trying to steal jobs and steal things. And actually, the true story, as we just heard, is those people were settled on places like Texas, Arizona, other places, and the U.S. came and took all of their land and all that they had. Wow, imagine that. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
There's a land, so I've been told. Every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the borderline. And when it's time to take your turn, here's a lesson you must learn. You will lose more than you'll ever hope to find.
All right, welcome back. That was Bob Avakian, and he was performing that song along with Outer National, Across the Borderline, okay? And it's a really very moving song, and I thought it was very important to play that in relation to what's going on in the world today. And I thought it was also important to play it, well, just for what it brings out, okay? I think it's extremely important. I thought it was very, very beautiful that Avakian and Outer National did that. And it means something in the world, folks. Let's not get all, you know, hide it up and say, you know, act like we don't have to have beautiful culture, powerful culture. We have to have things that actually express good things for people, all right? As well as the truth about what the hell is going on in the world. All right, you know, just last night I had a chance to talk with Paige Courage Klein, who was representing from No More Deaths, and she was representing some of the people that have been put on trial. There's been 9 people facing charges, 8 of them facing misdemeanor charges, 1 facing felony charges. We were talking about the first of 3 trials, and our conversation took place just as the trial was ending. Since our interview, the federal magistrate conducting the trial found all 4 defendants guilty, and sentencing will be scheduled within the next 10 days. This is an outrageous verdict against people whose actions have had one purpose: to save the lives of migrants in the face of government policies meant to kill those crossing the southern border. If you want to support the work of No More Deaths or just find out more about it, follow the trials and share all of this with your friends, go to nomoredeaths.org. Once again, that is nomoredeaths.org. You can also follow them on Twitter at No More Deaths. So let's get into the interview with Paige Courage Klein. No More Deaths is a humanitarian organization based in southern Arizona. Since 2008, they have been an official ministry of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Tucson. The mission of No More Deaths is to end death and suffering in the Mexico-U.S. borderlands through people of conscience working openly and in community to uphold fundamental human rights. Members of No More Deaths were charged with federal crimes last year after attempting to deliver food, water, and other supplies to migrants on the Arizona side of the Sonoran Desert in the Cabeza Prieta National Wildlife Refuge. The trial is the first of a series of legal proceedings against humanitarian aid activists helping migrants and refugees on the southern frontier. And the names of the four No More Deaths volunteers that are on trial right now are Natalie Hoffman, Una Holcomb, Madeline Hoos, and Zachila Orozco McCormick. Right, and joining us to talk about all this right now is Paige Courage Klein. Paige, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's jump into this. Can you fill out what the mission of No More Deaths is, and just to give people a better overall understanding of the organization and its mission?
Yeah, so I'm a volunteer with No More Deaths. It's a mainly volunteer-run humanitarian aid group based in southern Arizona, and our mission is to end death and suffering on the U.S.-Mexico border, mostly focused on migrant deaths and disappearances. We are most well known for putting out food and water drops on known migrant trails in areas where people have died in the past. And then we have a series of other projects, such as abuse documentation, kind of tracking Border Patrol abuses. And then also we do some legal workshops here in Tucson. And we have a search and rescue team that does non-law enforcement search and rescue of missing migrants.
Now, just so people get a, and this is interesting because I didn't realize this was part of what you do, but just so people get a sense of like what life is like for people trying to come to this country from other countries, when you talk about abuse documentation, what is it that you're talking about there in terms of the abuse that they face?
We actually mostly just do documentation of abuses on the U.S. side at the hands of Border Patrol. So we have a report series that we've been publishing over the past few years called Disappeared, and it's focused on just the crisis of death and disappearance in the borderlands. And so part one was focused on deadly enforcement practices by Border Patrol, looking at the way that Border Patrol agents will chase and scatter groups of migrants into remote areas where they then become disoriented, lost, and sometimes die. Part two was called Interference with Humanitarian Aid. A lot of people are familiar with a video of Border Patrol agents destroying water gallons, but we released that as well as some analysis of logbook data that we had from our water drops. And then part three, which hasn't actually come out yet, we're still doing a bunch of analysis, is about emergency non-response. So looking at just the lack of search and rescue done by law enforcement and local authorities in southern Arizona. We've seen that there's a very compromised response when somebody who calls 911 speaks Spanish and is presumed to be a border crosser. They often don't have somebody go look for them. So we're documenting a discriminatory emergency response practice.
Mm-hmm. Now, over the last year, the organization has been hit pretty hard by the federal government, criminally prosecuted for doing and carrying out this mission. And the first four people are currently on trial. Can you explain to people what they're on trial for and what has happened so far?
Yes, right now it's the first trial for our Cabeza 9 defendants. So nine of our volunteers in the summer of 2017 were stopped. It was actually three different incidences where they were stopped while doing humanitarian aid on the Cabeza Prieta National Wildlife Refuge, which is an area that we know to be kind of a hotspot for migrant deaths and disappearances. In 2014, we started recovering a lot of human remains and finding people that had died, and we also have gotten a lot of missing persons reports from that area of people that we've gone out and looked for but haven't found. So these volunteers were out putting out food and water in one of the hottest, deadliest summers on record. And they actually, none of them were cited or charged in the field. They were sent letters or had Fish and Wildlife come and knock on their door in Bellingham, Washington, and New Orleans, and Minneapolis. All these volunteers kind of live all over the country, and they were given their charging papers like months after the fact. And so this was the first of those trials. And it actually just ended Thursday evening was the end of the trial. So we're currently waiting for a verdict from the judge.
And what would people be facing?
These four defendants are part of the Cabeza 9. It's 9 of our volunteers that are facing misdemeanor charges for putting out food and water on the Cabeza Prieta National Wildlife Refuge, which is it's a wildlife refuge, but a lot of it is a wilderness area. And it's an area that we started going to in 2014. And when we started hiking into some of these more remote areas, we started finding a lot of people who had died and realized that when we looked at maps of known migrant deaths, those areas were blank, but it was just because nobody had gotten that far into the wilderness to find these folks who had passed. So we started really ramping up our presence there and putting out more food and water. And the refuge itself responded by changing their permit application language to specifically ban leaving food, water, water containers, blankets, medical supplies, and clothing, which was directly targeted at our volunteer base. And so now we have 9 defendants, and the first 4 of them just finished up trial on Thursday afternoon. There's 4 of them, and one has a charge that's operating a motor vehicle in a wilderness area, and then the rest of them have entering a wildlife refuge without a permit and abandonment of property. Just to clarify on the operating a motor vehicle in a wilderness area, our volunteers were driving on a road, but it was an administrative road that is not open to the public. But it's the only road access to get into some of these really key areas where we've documented a literal trail of death, where there's a line of people who year after year are found dead in the same area. And the only way to really get in there when it's hot is to drive on this road.
Mm. Now, what you're talking about is, I mean, it's very moving, and it's very, you know, it's also enraging to think that people are being prosecuted for this. The members of No More Deaths, you guys you're being prosecuted for doing whatever you can to stop the suffering and death of large numbers of immigrant people. And their only crime is trying to make their way into a place where they might be able to make a living. They might be able to stay alive, feed their families back home, whatever. When you talk about what could happen to the people, basically to the No More Deaths people, what is it that they would be facing in terms of the punishment?
So these volunteers are facing up to 6 months in jail. That's mm-hmm. the maximum penalty. And I think, I don't know if it's $5,000 or $10,000 in fines, but it's some pretty hefty fines as well.
Okay. I just wanted to be clear on that because I think it's important that people know that this is not going to be just a slap on the hand, that they're going after this. And in a sense, they also, which we can talk about a little bit later, but they're also not just going after these individuals, but really looking to break the back of the organization itself.
Yeah, definitely. I think since we released the report, Interference with Humanitarian Aid, since Trump has come into office, it seems like there's been a pretty intense backlash towards our organization. And really, I think it comes at a time where there's nationwide really a trend of kind of ramping up the war against immigrants and the undocumented community, as well as really targeting organizers who are working for migrant justice. I do think it's significant that our organization is most of our membership are people who come from pretty high levels of privilege, and so it is definitely notable that the government is now kind of expanding the net and targeting people of privilege, which I think historically has really been an indicator of, you know, a more authoritarian regime. While we don't really want to center ourselves in the story because we know that the people getting the brunt of it are the folks crossing the border, it definitely does feel significant that our organization is being targeted.
Yeah, and it's something I want to get into, too, because it's, look, you know, there's a need for many more people like your organization and like you guys to actually be out there doing this kind of stuff. We're talking about the actual life and death of immigrant people, you know, people who are simply trying to get a way to stay alive, to feed their families back home, whatever, and they die on a pathway that they never should have been on in the first place if there had been any justice in the world, but that they are on, and then they're left out there to die, and the people that are trying to actually help them make it through are then prosecuted and threatened with jail and massive fines.
Yeah, you're preaching to the choir.
Good. This is the first of the trials, as you said, that the government has threatened. And in addition to another group of people also facing minor charges, one person, Dr. Scott Warren, is also facing a felony charge and the possibility of 20 years in jail. What's happening there?
So Scott is also actually a part of the Cabeza 9. So he will be going on trial February 25th. For his misdemeanor charges. I think he actually just has the operating a motor vehicle in wilderness and abandonment of property are his charges there. But he'll be facing those. Those are the first trials that he'll go to. And his felony case was actually just scheduled a few days ago. It's going to happen in late May and early June. So we're still kind of in the motions time period of his trial and process. But eventually this summer, we're going to have the actual trial happen. So we're kind of holding our breath to see what happens, and we're optimistic, but we also have just seen a real shift in the way that immigration law is being enforced and practiced in this country.
The No More Deaths has been heroic in both carrying out your mission with regard to immigrants making their way through the desert and exposing the actual role of what I think can only be referred to as the fascistic border patrol in relation to the immigrants, actually condemning immigrants attempting to make it across the border territory to death by sabotaging of supplies and water and other acts. How do you look at what's being done to the immigrants now?
I mean, I think what's happening is egregious. I think it's easy to say, oh, the system's broken, we need to fix it. But I think also our immigration policy for a really long time has been race-based, has never really prioritized people's needs. It really has just kind of looked at what the economic needs of the country are and tried to kind of fit in the undocumented community wherever it can best exploit them. So it has become more egregious. I think there's more people coming up, especially coming up to cross the border because of state violence in Central America and in indigenous communities in Mexico. You know, I think the Border Patrol was not prepared and has never been prepared to deal with the humanitarian crisis that they've created. And so we're seeing just more and more egregious things like the death of children in detention, Yaceline and Felipe, and it doesn't seem like it's going to get better, and it doesn't seem like they have the resources or the ability to handle it responsibly, because that's not what they're designed to do. They're designed to enforce, hunt, catch, and deport people, and they're being put in this role of kind of first initial contact of folks who are fleeing violence, and it's completely inappropriate.
Mm-hmm. This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm speaking with Paige Courage-Kleim of No More Deaths about the ongoing trials of activists on federal charges for carrying out humanitarian work along the border where thousands of immigrants have died in the past few decades as a result of government policies meant to cause their deaths. Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you as well is we're talking about all this and what was done. It's kind of heavy with it, with No More Deaths. It's actually being able to suss this out and point out what has been happening. You know, the fact that the Border Patrol, it wasn't just looking at the immigrants and chasing them down, but there actually was, and it's not, that wasn't a laugh of kind of like, oh, isn't this funny? It was actually like, this is outrageous. The fact that the Border Patrol actually is on somewhat of a mission without caring, basically. When they, like, for instance, they've been exposed as having, you know, broken, you know, the water containers, or there was this one thing you had on your site of this Border Patrol guy kind of snide and sneering and emptying cartons of water out on the ground, knowing that those were put there for the people, the migrants that were trying to come in and stay alive and get where they were going. And he was basically saying, to hell with that. And let's talk about that a little, because that says a lot about what's actually going on here. It's not about, it's not sort of just the violating rules or something like that, but there actually seems to be a very genocidal approach to this thing on the part of the border guards and the system itself.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they're taught to dehumanize the people that they're interacting with. They're taught to be afraid of them and think that they're all criminals and evil. And they, I think some of them have convinced themselves that that's true. And so the way that they then respond to our aid and what they think that that represents is they believe it's furthering people's presence in the U.S. And it makes sense that that's how they respond to it, because that's what they are being told and taught and being ingrained with. And it's, I don't think that they could do that job if they weren't able to convince themselves of those truths. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you look at that and you combine it with now the, what is it? I read something in one of your publications. I read something about the various military forces that have come together, military and quasi-military forces that have come together to actually carry out this campaign against immigrants.
The, you're talking about kind of the border militia groups?
Yeah.
They're definitely present as well, and there's a pretty violent and racist history of them in southern Arizona. I'm in one of the communities that we often work in, the town of Aravaca. A while back, the Minutemen were very active there, and members of the Minutemen militia actually participated in a home invasion. They had heard that this man, Raul Flores, had $1 million in his house and was involved in drug smuggling, and they actually raided his house, shot him, shot his 9-year-old daughter, Briseña Flores, and his wife was armed and shot back and called 911 and survived. But, you know, I think some of these militia movements, we talk about Border Patrol not being accountable, they're even less accountable. And the people who are involved with them, I think, are just really scary and unpredictable. And it's kind of this added layer of violence that has really flourished under the Trump administration and been really validated from the top and by individual Border Patrol agents on the ground as well.
I saw a report that also indicated that, like, portions of the U.S. military were actually involved in some of this.
The military has been deployed. There's a lot of limitations in what they're able to do. They are not able to enforce immigration law, but they have been installing razor wire, and there was a couple of videos that surfaced of them doing kind of like mob and riot control demonstrations in Nogales on the border. So there were just like lines of members of the army with these huge shields chanting right at the port of entry. They shut down all but one lane of traffic. So there's been kind of these like shows of force, but they are somewhat limited in what they're actually able to do on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things, too, is that in terms of getting a permit, like even you folks getting a permit to be able to go into the area that we're talking about, I read that the creation of the permit language, which was a joint effort. This is what it was. It was a joint effort of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, U.S. Air Force, U.S. Marines, and the Bureau of Land Management. That's a pretty big-sized grouping of schmucks.
So it's a interagency permit. So they all kind of came together and did it and, updated the language. Sometimes we go on to public areas of the Barry M. Goldwater Range. There's areas that they're not actively bombing that we can go on. And sometimes we'll go out there. But I think most of the bombing range, there's absolutely no public access. And the times that humanitarian aid groups or search and rescue groups have been able to go out there, it's been indicative of that being kind of just a massive graveyard. The Águilas del Desierto, which is a search and recovery group out of San Diego, has gone out there a couple weekends out onto the Barry M. Goldwater Range. And they had a weekend where they came across the remains of 11 different people who had died just in one weekend. So our group has not gained access to those areas at all, but we do know that a lot of people have gone missing out there.
Mm, boy. When you're talking about this, I can't imagine it, okay? It's like you know what happens to people, and you've probably seen the bodies, you've probably seen the bones. The route taken through this whole National Wildlife Refuge that we're talking about people going through is one of the deadliest corridors for immigrants. And I wanted to talk about that a little bit, because when you think about that in relation to what you just said, to me it raises up a question of a genocidal side of all this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just kind of all of these policies in collusion together. So you look at people who end up going missing on the bombing range, they're only walking on the bombing range because of U.S. border policy that has walled off the cities and funneled migration into these remote corridors. You know, you ask the question, well, why don't they apply the legal way? And hopefully we all know that that's impossible for most people and that our asylum process doesn't function. And then we look at, well, why did they even come to the border in the first place? And often those root causes have to do with U.S. imperialism and our foreign policy and the way we've treated Latin America over the past century. So I think all these things together do have kind of a targeting effect of making it so that we ensure that certain groups of people are not going to live full, wonderful lives. They're going to be forced into poverty and kept there, and if they try to escape that, the only way to do that is by walking 90 miles in 110 degree heat and risking death. So, you know, yeah, the options are really limited, and it's hard for me to not see the United States as one of the really, really responsible entities in that.
Mm-hmm. The government has charged the people that they've arrested and put on trial with misdemeanors, which not only covers up the reality of what's being carried out by the system on a regular basis, the stuff that you're speaking to, but also has huge implications for humanitarian work that's involved in aiding migrants in the immediate and long-term future as well. Let's talk about that a little bit, because it does actually, when they're charging people with this and they're accusing people of actually breaking the law in a way that cannot be allowed, let's talk about what that actually means. What is this trial going to mean for the work among migrants in the immediate and long-term future?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think it's already had an effect. I myself was banned from the Cabeza Prieta Wildlife Refuge for a year. I put water out there and was honest with an agent out there, because we are a transparent organization. And then I was put on a do not issue permit list, and I was on it for a year and just got off this past July. So it's hard for me to think about what I should do, because I want to put water on Cabeza Prieta, but I also know that I'm a part of the search and rescue, search and recovery team. And if I am not able to get a permit, that's an issue, because I know the area well and I've spent a lot of time out there and I'm capable of leading a search for somebody. And so in order to continue being able to do searches, I have to limit my role in trying to prevent those searches from being necessary in the first place, if that makes any sense. It's this pretty awful situation to be in, and I think a lot of us long-term people are kind of in that spot where we don't want to put water out there right now because we know that we might get banned for life and that our ability to access that land for search and rescue is really key and helpful because the government's not going to do that work. So I think these charges can have a really chilling effect and they can really limit the work that we're doing out there. I think they also have the ability to really bring us together and kind of show the true colors of the Department of the Interior and show how complicit they are and the ways in which they're utilizing environmental law and conservation ideas to further dehumanize and prosecute and target and just do all of these negative things that at the end of the day have really deadly consequences. You know, I don't want to have our volunteers be charged. I don't want to be in trial. And there's been moments where I'm also feel really thankful that we're being able to be put in the spotlight and tell this story, because a lot of the people that have been really directly affected by this aren't able to tell that story because they're not with us anymore.
Mm-hmm. Now, for the people out there that want to know one really important question, what now? What lies ahead now?
Well, next week I have a 2-day hike plan on Sabesa. So we're going to go out there and we're going to spend the night in the Growler Valley, and we're going to hike in some of these areas that we know are high needs. And the work continues. This week we're out putting out water in the Aravaca area. We've committed to providing humanitarian aid, and we're going to continue to do that. We're just going to have to kind of figure out the most effective way to intervene in this crisis. And now we have, you know, an additional factor, which is being targeted by the government. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to add that into our list of what we consider and continue our work because we can't stop.
Mm-hmm. What does it mean for the people that are facing charges and possibility of being in jail right now? And how can people actually express their support if they want to support that?
Yeah, well, people can write letters if they want to. We have a P.O. box. People can donate. We're big on social media. And, yeah, I think a lot of them are scared and, you know, we're unsure of what's going to happen. But we're also, you know, we're all together. We're hanging out at a friend's house right now and just kind of continuing with our lives and being optimistic. And I think at the end of the day, when I've talked to everybody about it, they know that what they did was the right thing to do. And they know that whatever the law was, whatever the government says the rules were and what was broken and what wasn't, I feel so humbled by the things that I've heard them say on the stand over the past few days, you know, people saying that they respond to like a higher calling and like a higher morality than what U.S. environmental law says in this case, or, you know, people just recognizing that water is such a sacred thing and that when people are dying of thirst, you have to put water out for them. I think everybody's in good spirits. We're going to see what comes.
And people should be really paying a lot of close attention to this because there's two more trials at least coming up. You know, there's the continuation of the trial that we've been talking about. There's the four other people that are going to be put on trial. And
yep.
Then Scott, yes. And those things are important for people to have the backs of the people being charged and put on trial. And I think that's really important for people to figure out ways that they can actually, how they can actually follow the trials, how they can show their support. How would that be?
One of our defendants I remember talking to, and she's absolutely amazing. But I think what she kind of said to me was, she told me, I want people to keep doing the work. She was like, I'm going to be fine, but I want people to keep doing the work. And so I guess I would, for folks kind of across the country, I think that's maybe the message to take away is keep track, watch what's happening to us and support us in the ways that you can, but also engage in your own community because we're out here on the border, but the border affects people everywhere. And in any community you're in across the country, there's undocumented people there that are being targeted right now. And so you don't need to come to Arizona to engage in this work. Anybody that you can keep in your community and prevent from being deported, that's one less person that we need to put water out for. So, you know, I think people should just look around at what's available to them, what connections they already have in their community, and engage there.
All right, Paige, thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
And we'll definitely stay in touch. It's really important talking about this, and it's been good talking with you.
All right, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot, Paige. All right, welcome back. That was, actually an extremely important piece that people need to keep their eyes on. They need to keep their eyes on what's developing in that and overall, and in particular with the other trials coming up. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Mm-hmm.
All right, welcome back. That was Outer National, Somos Todos Ilegales. All right, now for most of us, we're really keenly aware of what's been going on in relation to the situation developing in this country right now, and it's one and the various nodal points that are happening. And right now, I wanted to run something that I think is extremely important. And this is a piece done by Bob Avakian, and he's the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And it really speaks very dramatically and powerfully to the question of women and the oppression of women and what where it comes from and what do we need to do, all right? So this is, it comes from a speech that Avakian made called, and a recording that's available called, a film that's available actually, called BA Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less, a speech by Bob Avakian in the fall of 2012. So let's just jump right into that and we'll be right back after that.
At the same time, millions of women and girls are enslaved in prostitution and in the degradation of the ever more vicious and violent pornography, many forced into this as well, not only out of economic hardship, but literal brutality. A number of years ago, I gave a talk called Unresolved Contradictions, Driving Forces for Revolution. And in that, I spoke to the fact that a comrade in our party had pointed out to me in relation to an earlier talk I gave, Revolution, why it's necessary, why it's possible, and what it's all about, that there was a very real and vivid parallel between the situation of women, particularly in pornography and prostitution, and the way the phenomenon that I described in beginning that talk, Revolution. I began that talk with descriptions of the postcards of the hanging. Now think about this. Literally in this country, up until the 1950s and into the early 1960s, in many of our lifetimes, black people were being repeatedly lynched. But that's not all. Usually this took place in the South. And many times, when these black men in particular would be lynched, it would be done in a carnival atmosphere. People would be notified in advance that this was going to happen. People, whole families, including little children, would come to picnic at the site of the lynching. And when the black man's body was lynched, mutilated, and burned, pieces of the mutilated body would be handed out to some in the crowd as trophies. This is the f***ing history of this country. And I know it's hard to hear, but we need to face the reality of what the history of this country and how it's been built actually is. And then photographs would be taken of the burned, mutilated, and lynched bodies of these black men. And postcards would be made and they would be sold around the country. And this comrade pointed out, and I spoke to this in Unresolved Contradictions, Driving Forces for Revolution, that what goes on, particularly in the increasingly violent and vicious pornography, is very much along the same lines as the postcards of the hanging. The titillation of men through the physical torture and degradation of women, which is becoming more and more the norm and more mainstream in pornography. We should all think about the fact that one of the most popular forms of pornography as it's being more and more mainstream is rape pornography, depicting literally the woman being raped. And this comrade also pointed out, and I think it's very important to think about, that you can do in this society today to women what you could not do to any other group without a huge outcry. I mean, think about what's depicted in pornography, even so-called softcore, let alone hardcore, vicious and violent pornography. Imagine if someone made a film depicting black people in grotesque caricature with gigantic teeth and a big smile eating watermelons. and dancing around saying, yes, sir, massa, yes, sir, massa. Can you imagine that you can have that done without a huge outcry? No, and that's very right. It should not be able to be done without a huge outcry. Or imagine if you literally showed lynchings and depicted them as a source of titillation. But yet you can do what I've been describing in pornography, and not only is there not a huge outcry, but it's being more and more mainstream. And by the way, it's multi-billion dollar business. It's not just some sleazy old men in San Fernando Valley who are churning this out. This involves big banks and financial institutions. It involves big hotel chains involved in multi-billion dollar business. And it's becoming more, as I said, more and more mainstream. Even the television programs, which are not pornographic themselves, literally. How often do you hear when talking about guys, oh, let's watch some porn? It's just integrated into the story as if it's just perfectly natural. And then think about the content that I've been just touching on and can't really give full life to. I mean, it's just so disgusting. It's so outrageous. Think about this content that's being mainstreamed. And along with this, women are subjected to continual assaults on their right to abortion and even birth control. Don't let these people tell you, these so-called right-to-lifers, that the issue is the killing of innocent babies. The issue is the control over women exercised by forcing them to be mothers, whether or not they want to be at that time. Now, to have children, to raise children, can be a really beautiful experience if that's what you want to do and if you feel in a position to do it in the way that you feel that it should be done. But to have it forced on you is virtual enslavement. Not to even have the choice as to whether you will do that. And here's the key to how you know, or one key to how you know this is not about killing of innocent babies. Try to find one of these rabid anti-abortion groups that is also not opposed to birth control. You'll have a very hard time. They're all opposed to birth control because the issue is not the killing of innocent babies. It's the control and subordination of women who are regarded as getting all out of hand these days in this society, which is another reason why we have, or a contributing factor to why we have this vicious pornography. So the goal of these attacks on abortion and, yes, on birth control, the right to them, is to deny women the ability to determine something as basic as when or if they will have children and raise children or be part of raising them, forcing motherhood on them once again and enslaving them in that way. Along with all this, millions of women and girls, millions every year in this country alone, are raped, assaulted, battered, and abused, often by those who claim to be their intimate lovers, while the half of humanity that is female is everywhere treated as less than fully human. Once again, I think about the experience of black people and slavery. You know what one of the main terms the slave owners used to describe the slaves? Talking tools. Because this is how they regarded them, and this is how they were treated. They were put on the auction block to be sold, and their physical attributes were examined. Their teeth, if they were women, their reproductive potential, their body shapes, their ability to work hard, their musculature. All this was examined in the most degrading way. And you think of the same thing with women today. Reduced to objects to be used by men. Treated as brood animals to turn out babies. And as unthinking flesh to be consumed and plundered with their bodies and body parts used to sell products, pimped out and beaten into submission, plundered to portray and promote sex as conquest and domination by men instead of shared pleasure based on mutual affection and equality. All of this degrades and demeans not only the women who are directly subjected to the most extreme forms of this, but all women everywhere. What kind of system is this? And why should anyone accept that this is the best possible way the world could be? And those whose sexual orientation is different from and seen as posing a threat to the dominant gender and sex relations, lesbians and gays, bisexual and transgendered people, or those who are simply unsure about their sexuality and questioning it at a given time, are harassed, bullied, often bullied to the point of committing suicide, brutalized and even murdered. And despite certain changes in law and government policy, the reality of LGBT people being discriminated against, insulted, and even assaulted continues as a marked feature of the culture and society, bound up with deep-seated structural relations of this whole system, closely connected to the patriarchy and male supremacy that oppress women.
All right, real quick, that's really very, very, very important. That was Bob Avakian talking about the oppression of women. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my guests today, Alvaro Huerta and Paige Courage-Klein, and Bob Avakian for the piece on the oppression of women. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com.
I want to hear your thoughts, see it all. Like a heat waves through the walls. You want to go out tonight. You want to know what it's like when the wind's in your lungs and the fire is in the